the 10th episode of the ongoing series, The 10 Lost Tribes in Jewish Consciousness, here on Sfarim Cheder. I'm Nachi Weinstein. In this episode of the series, we once again will return to the figure of Antonio de Montezinos, Aaron Halevi, and his relación, as relayed by Menashe ben Israel in his Mikveh Israel, the Hope of Israel, Esperanza de Israel. And this episode is, so there is overlap, definitely, with the previous episode, but it also focuses a little bit more on the broader context of the relación and of de Montezinos. Before the next episode, we'll move on to Menashe himself and his work. Additionally, I'll mention here that there will be another episode later this week, which will be on about Lechem HaPanim, and you can stay tuned for that. That has to do with this week's Parsha, Parshas Emor. The corporate sponsor of this series, as always, Gluck Plumbing. For all your service needs, big or small, in New Jersey, with a full service division from boiler replacements, main sewer lines, snakeouts, cameraing main lines, to a simple faucet leak, Gluck Plumbing Service Division has you covered. Give them a call, 732-523-1836, extension 1. To sponsor an individual episode of this series or of the podcast, you can check out the links and the information in the show's notes below. You can also check out links to the Sfarim Cheder Substack, and if you would like to submit an essay, you can do so as well. You can email me. You can also check out a link to the Sfarim Cheder YouTube, as well as the Sfarim Cheder WhatsApp chat, which is an admin-only chat where I post many new Sfarim books and all that kind of thing. I still do that on Twitter or X, but more, there's much more on the WhatsApp chat. And finally, you can please subscribe, rate, or review the podcast. I appreciate that wherever you listen to your podcast, but especially on Apple, you can review and rate. Also, I want to mention one new feature that now is, you can see in the show's notes, you'll see questions, comments, feedback, send us a message. It's the first thing. It's a hyperlink. You can click it. It'll take you to send a text message from your phone. You can send a message, and that way you can you could still send an email, or if you're on the WhatsApp chat, send a WhatsApp to me, but you can do so that way, and I'll get the message through the podcast. So if you have any feedback or comments you want to leave it, you can leave it that way. And with that, enjoy the episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Cheder podcast. On this episode of the podcast and another episode in the ongoing series in the 10 Lost Tribes in Jewish Consciousness, I'll be joined by Professor Jonathan Schorsch, who holds the chair in Jewish Religious and Intellectual History at the University of Potsdam in Germany, and he's the author of a number of books. And we'll be talking about Antonio de Montezinos, Aaron Halevi, and the Relacion. This is something that Professor Schorsch has a chapter, but it's like 100 pages. It's almost like its own book in one of your books,
right.
I think.
Right.
It's pretty long. So we'll be discussing him and the Relacion, and more than with Professor Ronnie Perelis, who also discussed this topic, but this is more about the context of the Relacion and Montezinos and his world and that type of thing. So thank you, Professor Schorsch, for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start off. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
Myself and my background. I grew up in New York. I still feel very much like a New Yorker. I went to SAR Academy, went to Bronx High School of Science, went to Columbia University. Many years later, ended up teaching at Columbia for 9 years. I've been in Berlin now for 7 years. My father is a historian who's retired and a rabbi. And interestingly, given that I'm back in Germany, whatever that means, my grandfather was a rabbi of the conservative movement, although it wasn't called that at the time, back in Germany before fleeing in the late 30s. So, yeah. I feel very blessed to have this history, and I guess where I ended up is not so surprising given that.
So your books, I think one of the books is Swimming the Christian Atlantic. You have a bunch of books on these topics of conversos and different topics in the area in the Atlantic. So it's not German history. How did you become interested in this history?
Right. Excellent question. It's not German Jewish history, although it's more similar than I might have imagined. So my master's thesis and my PhD dissertation were both on the relationship between Jews and Blacks, mostly in the colonial world, mostly outside of the United States. And most of the Jews in that equation were Sephardic Jews. So that was sort of the way I got to talking about Sephardic Jews and conversos. I think I also imagined that somehow dealing with Sephardic Jews would be a welcome respite from the stiff yekkes, you know, and the arrogant, self-important yekkes. But in fact, my Sephardim, the Western Sephardim, are very, very similar to the yekkes. They're sort of like yekkes, you know, in advance, you know. Very similar. They're very proud. They're very, you know, they romanticize and they're very proud of their glorious history, and they see themselves as very different than those lowly Ashkenazim and Polaks, you know, who are barely civilized. And so, yeah, so it's sort of, these are not the Sephardim I deal with in the Atlantic world, which I find fascinating, are very different than the Eastern Sephardim, you know, the Balkan and the North African Sephardim. So yeah, it's interesting.
Now, how about Montezinos? Let's just jump right into Montezinos. The chapter in your book is called, the title is Rereading, the R-E's in parentheses, Reading or Rereading, right, yes. The Old / New World in the 1640s, the Relación of Antonio de Montezinos. How did you become interested in Montezinos and in the Relación?
Well, he fits right into so much of what's going on in the Atlantic world at the time, and which I just find fascinating. You know, the whole history of the conversos, right? The Inquisition, the rise of worsening anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism, depending on which term you want to use, the invention of new Christians, you know, the invention of these converted Jews, starting go as far back as 1390, and the massacres of that year, and then the creation of this entire population of crypto. You know, crypto Jews, people who are ostensibly on the surface Catholics, but who have all kinds of different Jewish background and knowledge and loyalties. So that whole history, and you know, the Spanish Jews who flee over the mountains to Portugal after 1492, and then the Portuguese king who converts the entire Jewish population of his realm in one fell swoop at the point of a sword, you know, in one moment, in 1497. So that you have this bizarre, you know, really surreal situation of entire nation's Jews who are now declared Catholic, and the resulting confusion and consequences of that, among other things, that the fact that you have this entire community converted at once means that now suddenly, you know, the butcher is now suddenly Catholic, the rabbi is suddenly Catholic, the chazan is suddenly Catholic, so. And then, you know, the Portuguese king gives them a grace period of 50 years, says, I'm not going to bring the Inquisition. I'm going to give you, you know, time to become good Catholics, which, of course, did the opposite. It gave them 50 years to sort of continue their confused crypto life. And then you have many of them, you know, filtering out of Portugal to the colonies, Brazil, among other places. And you have the creation of, you know, they flee elsewhere to Northern and Western Europe. So you have the creation of new Jewish communities, which hadn't existed in these lands, the Netherlands, England, since the early Middle Ages, the Middle Ages. So you have these new, you know, what Joseph Kaplan called new Jews, these communities made up of Sephardim, ex-conversos, depending on what we want to call them. So that's one side of it, which is just fascinating, all amazing. And then the fact that, you know, these mostly Portuguese Jews, but these new Jews, these ex-conversos create really a commercial empire that is so successful, so dominant, that they are literally competing with the greatest empires of the time, England, France, you know, the Netherlands. Even though they have no territory of their own, they have no real unified political structure. It's astonishing. And then the whole other side, which I find fascinating, is obviously the context of all of that is, you know, European overseas expansion, it's colonization, it's slavery. This is really, you could argue, this is the beginning of globalization in a certain way. This is the beginning of the world that we live in, the world as we know it, you know, multicultural, multinational, of global expanse. And then you have the whole ethnic side of it. The question of the meeting of all of these peoples who have never even known of each other's existence, figuring out this whole kind of racial and religious hierarchy. It's an incredibly turbulent, disturbing, amazing time. And you know, I, again, it's really astonishingly modern. You read about the 17th century, and it's not in certain ways so distant from the 20th, 21st century in certain respects. So that's the other side of it. And then in terms of Montesinos, you know, he obviously is dealing with the topic that brought me here today, you know, these amazing, this rhetoric, this discourse about things like the lost 10 tribes, the coming of the Messiah, the kind of restitution of and redemption of the people of Israel. And here, you know, all of that, which is interesting enough on its own, now takes on the hues of the surrounding places and times, which is, you know, this whole ethnic, racial kind of turbulence. So I just find that all incredibly compelling and riveting.
Okay, so thank you for that background. And that's something we're going to dive into more. Like I already mentioned, listeners may be familiar with some of the story. We went into the relation with Professor Ronnie Pirellis, who you do discuss in this chapter. But let's recap, because I think it's good for the episode to stand on its own a little bit. Let's recap Montesinos, you know, the story, the relation, the story, as it's related sure. in Menashe ben Israel's Mikveh Yisrael, Hope of Israel. And that's where that is. We can talk a little bit as publication history as well. And then we can get into back into what you were talking about, its context, the background, the setting okay. in the mid-17th century. Great. So let's talk, if you want to just explain the relation, talk about it a little bit, the text itself.
Great. You probably know it as well as I do by now. with pleasure. It's a fascinating text, I find. Very brief, really a handful of pages. It seems to be a recording of, transcription of, paraphrase of testimony that he gave, Antonio de Montesinos, who had taken on the Jewish name of Aaron Levy. He was of Portuguese background, and he came to Amsterdam in, 1644, and kind of created a stir there. People were fascinated, apparently, by his stories of having traveled in Nueva Granada, you know, one of the Spanish territories in South America, what we would call today Colombia, more or less. And he claims to have met people from the Lost Ten Tribes. So he related his story, and this relation is the result of it. So the story is basically he's there, he's a merchant, he's doing his business there in Nueva Granada, New Granada, named obviously after the southern Spanish province, and he is doing his business with some Native Americans, and the Native Americans are complaining about the Spanish, how cruel they are, how brutal they are, and how much the natives suffer under them. He's sort of intrigued. He sort of defends the Spanish a little bit, but not wholeheartedly. He's then arrested by the Inquisition all of a sudden. He's let go a few days later for lack of evidence. And he's still intrigued by what he has heard from these Native Americans, particularly the one leader of this little group that he's been working with or that they've been helping him, Francisco. And he goes back to meet him, and he finds him, and Francisco proceeds to tell him this whole kind of fascinating tale of this people that lives sort of amidst the Native Americans, but doesn't really relate to them, and they're not connected really to each other. But Francisco's people have this relationship with these other hidden people, and as it turns out, they are supposedly descended from the tribe of Reuben. And of course, our hero, our protagonist, is amazed, incredulous. And begs Francisco to take him to meet them, and they go, and they have this whole encounter, which is almost like at the foot of a mountain, which is almost like the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And he gets to meet these representatives, not really in depth and not really in person so much, but he hears this whole kind of revelation from them, this whole kind of communication from them, a day-long communication, and they have all kinds of things that they convey to him, and he wants to know more. He tries to cross the river that's separating him from them and doesn't quite do it, but in the end, what is revealed to him by Francisco, as much as by these Reubenites themselves, is that they will come out of hiding at a certain point, and they will really overthrow the Spanish, They will unite, kind of ally with the Native Americans, and they will restore the Jews, and everything will be good. So this is just a wonderful new installation, if you will, and a wonderful new episode in this whole Lost Ten Tribes history. So that's kind of the relation itself. As I said, again, it's very short, a few pages. And Menashe ben Israel, who meets Aaron Levy or Antonio de Montezinos in Amsterdam, is very, very, seemingly very, very convinced by him. Finds him a credible witness, finds him a credible source, and he takes this text and he uses it as the kind of introduction to his whole very famous book from 1650, Mikveh Yisrael, Esperanza de Israel, The Hope of Israel. And there's a lot we can say, we can talk about that, the relationship between the text of Montezinos and Menashe ben Israel's text, which is rather very different. And Menashe has his own purposes in writing his text. But really, in some main sense, what Menashe is trying to do in his text is unpack the relationship between Jews and Native Americans, right? There's a lot of mythology circulating around at the time that the Native Americans descend from the Jews, perhaps even from the Lost Ten Tribes. And so Menashe is trying to weigh in on that. And he's also trying to weigh in on a question that is intriguing and kind of exciting. A lot of Christian millenarians, Christians looking to the end of days in England, and they have their own theories about who the Native Americans are and what the discovery of these new worlds over on the other side of the Atlantic mean for European history, for the history of the Christians. And Menashe essentially throws down the gauntlet and says, well, I'm going to enter your debate and discussion, and I'm going to show you that here's the real relationship, right? The Jews are not the Native Americans, and the Native Americans do not derive from the Jews. But perhaps there is some other kind of meaningful hidden relationship. And I would argue that the Mikveh Yisrael, the text of Menashe ben Israel on a whole, some scholars say that he wrote it in order to convince Cromwell to readmit the Jews to England. And that's perfectly plausible. I feel that the text of Menashe ben Israel is a pretty overtly Jewish text. It's pretty overtly arguing a kind of Jewish redemption, Jewish Messiah. You could almost argue a kind of Jewish proto-Zionism in a certain limited respect. So I don't know how it would have convinced Cromwell to, you know, let the Jews back into England. I think it was more part of Menashe ben Israel's kind of theopolitics, if you will. Let me just leave it at that, because, you know, we'll get back into all kinds of related things.
Yeah, we'll get back to Menashe. So, but one thing to ask about Menashe right away is Montezinos. So the text as we have it in the various editions, it comes from Mikveh Israel, right? We don't have, as you said, it wasn't a text. It was related over. It was a transcript or set over, whatever it was. We don't. So we know it through Menashe's words, essentially. Mm-hmm. So right. not saying that he altered it, but that's how we have it. And something else, you know, there's interesting things about it is, as you said, there was this question of the Native Americans, were they descended of the Jews of those tribes? And the relación and Menashe's work, like Israel, is very clear that they're not. It's saying that there were amongst the Native Americans hidden. And not only that, Montezinos is very clear that it's just Reuven. He's not mentioning the other tribes, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's all almost everything about these texts is interesting. Yeah. The text we only have from Menashe ben Israel, that's true. I did find, the appendix, which I might not have sent you, but the appendix, I did find a letter in Italian from Montezinos to Avram Pereira, Elias Pereira, but who I think is Avram Pereira, very well-known, very famous, really probably one of the wealthiest of the members of the Sephardic community in Amsterdam, although he was in... if it's the same person, who the recipient was in Italy at the time. But so that's the only autonomous version of the text that I know of. But I don't believe that Menashe ben Israel wrote the text. I mean, I find it a little bit hard to believe. It would mean that he's really engaged in a kind of forgery. I don't think there was any need for him to do that. The text is what it is, and it is absolutely typical of that genre of reports about lost tribes and that genre of travel writing. I think Menashe ben Israel makes a lot of use of it. I think he finds it very convenient for his own purposes. But I don't think there's enough evidence to prove one way or the other who actually wrote the text. And it's very possible that Menashe ben Israel helped edit it, you know, helped curate it, as we would say today. Now, the other, yeah, so the peoples that he meets are not Native Americans. These Reubenite tribes, these Lost Ten tribes, are hidden among the Native Americans. And that, too, is absolutely in fitting with all of the reports going back to Eldad Hadani. Anyone who reports about the Lost Ten Tribes, they're always living among these peoples in some exotic location, but they never mingle with them. It's another example of, showing the importance of Jewish purity. Right, Jews don't, you know, intermingle. They don't lose their lashon. They don't intermarry. They don't lose their names, as we say about another very particular form of exile in Egypt. Right, so that is totally in fitting with the whole genre. And there too, that's why I say that Menashe ben Israel's text is very Jewish. In other words, he's basically throwing it back in the faces of his Christian interlocutors and saying, that's all sweet. You believe that the natives descend from the Jews, but here's why they don't. And in fact, one of Menashe ben Israel's arguments is rather racist, right? Or certainly racialist. He says, listen, the Jews are all good looking. They're all comely and handsome, and the natives are not. They're ugly. You know, they're kind of savages. So that's Menashe ben Israel's way of saying there's no connection. Don't imagine that there's a connection. You know, the reason Christians were imagining that connection fits into their own messianic eschatological schema, right? If the Native Americans are parts of the Lost Ten Tribes, right, and they can be claimed or reclaimed for Christianity, then that's another beautiful instance of the conversion of the Jews, right? So that makes a lot of sense if you're a Catholic or a Protestant. And what Menashe ben Israel is saying is no. The Native Americans may hate the Spanish. They may be oppressed by the Spanish. They may want to rise up and overthrow you, and maybe they will, but that none of that means that they're Jews. What it does mean is that there is a parallelism. There is a shared political, or again, we could say theopolitical interests that both Jews and Native Americans share, which is the hatred of Christian imperialism and oppression and intolerance and so on. And again, I would argue that's a pretty assertive argument for the 17th century for Menashe ben Israel to make, especially given his known proclivity to friendships and communications with Christians. And he did. He was very interested in that, and he benefited from it, and he was very interested in upholding a Jewish voice. And here we see that his friendship and all these communications did not mean that he was lowering the standards of what he felt were kind of presenting the Jewish arguments, you know?
Okay, and maybe we'll get back to more Menashe at the end. So I want to get back to Montezinos and the Relacion. So you said at the beginning, the whole background, the backdrop of what was going on with these Western Sephardim, with the Amsterdam Jewish community, the former conversos, Spanish Portuguese Jews, and what's going on in the colonial world. Where does the Relacion and the Montezinos fit in there? How does this story about the lost tribes, you know, the Reubenites, from Montezinos' angle, not, you know, we mentioned kind of Menashe thing, but from Montezinos, where does this fit into that world?
It fits into it absolutely perfectly. I mean, you know, we have to remember that there was messianic speculation always among Jews. And when you have this new population of forcibly converted Jews who are called new Christians, who are called new Christians for hundreds of years, even if their family was converted five, seven generations earlier, right? It's a crazy instance of kind of racialism, you know. You cannot ever leave or escape your Jewishness, even when you become Christian. So among the conversos, there was immense messianic speculation for even more obvious reasons, right? Now it's not only that the Jews are oppressed, but now you have these Jews who have been forced to become Christians, and they were many of them who, you know, on the one hand, you have many who were fine being Christians now, maybe, but many of them were incredibly distressed and unhappy and had no interests in being Christian, right? So they maintained their Jewish loyalties. They maintained as best they could Jewish practices, Jewish knowledge. So you have all kinds of instances of mysticism and messianic speculation among the conversos. You have women kind of prophets, you know, who are interpreting dreams or relating their own visions and dreams. And you have many conversos reporting to the Inquisition or to others their own visions of the coming of the Messiah, who's going to, you know, make them Jews again, bring them out from under the oppressive yoke of the Catholics, and possibly even bring them back to the Holy Land. And there are many, many examples of that. So by the time you get to Montezinos, and we know nothing about his background, we know his father's name. I have tried to put together a genealogy for him, but was absolutely unable to do so. It could very well be that he's related to some of the other Montezinoses who are around in the 17th century, some of whom are quite wealthy merchants. But I was not able to really figure out who he is. We know nothing about his background before this relation. He shows up in Amsterdam kind of out of the blue. He was on the way to Brazil, but he decided to come to Amsterdam instead. But he leaves Amsterdam within 2 years. He goes to Brazil. He dies 3 years after that. And that's about all we know about him. There's one essay about him by a descendant of the family. They have some family traditions, which she reports on, which are kind of interesting. But yeah, there's like so many figures from that period. There's just much more that we don't know than what we do know. But so his relation is clearly picking up on these discourses about the lost tribes, right? That the lost tribes are there waiting, and when they're given the signal, they are going to sweep out, and they're incredibly skilled warriors, and their large numbers of soldiers will be the force that basically saves Israel. And they will, again, overthrow the Christians. And there are different versions of it, obviously, but they will restore the Jews to sovereignty. They will restore the Jews to the Holy Land. And we will be entering the Messianic days. So for Montezinos, as a converso, if he had Jewish knowledge, if he had loyalties and practiced anything Jewish, this would have been a narrative that would have really cheered him up, would have given him courage and hope and made him feel that there's a future, you know, that all is not lost. God has not abandoned us, and we will escape. We will be liberated from this horrible condition. So it makes total sense, right? Now, again, as I said, what's so wonderful to me about his text is how that whole long-standing discourse about the lost ten tribes is now mapped onto this new discourse based on European overseas expansion and colonization, with all kinds of new peoples, ethnicities, and races. And he finds in these Native Americans a kind of incredible mirror. A distorting mirror, of course, but an incredible mirror that reflects on the situation of the conversos. It parallels it. It's also somewhat different from it. And then you have this mythological people that's somehow hidden away in the middle of the Americas, right? That they are the lost 10 tribes. And again, for Montezinos, it serves an incredible purpose. The Native Americans hate the Spanish. They're going to overthrow them. But if the Native Americans weren't, in theory, powerful enough, after all, that was still, it was still a fairly large population that outnumbered the Spanish in the 17th century. And there were long-standing, ongoing Spanish fears of rebellion by Native Americans, which is easy to understand given the way they were treated and the way they were colonized and taken over. But there's another people even more powerful, which is this hidden Reubenite people. And so Montezinos gets to subvert, overturn all of these Catholic, Spanish, and Portuguese imaginings and narratives about the significance of the discovery of the Americas, right? Narratives that, for instance, said that the Americas were God's gift to Spain and Portugal, right? That this was a kind of promised land almost that God was giving to them, right? And that the discovery of the Americas and the conquest of the Americas was, again, another sign of God's favor toward the Spaniards and Portuguese. And since the Catholic Church was the real Israel, the new Israel, all of this shows that it all justifies and legitimates the Catholic self-image, right? We are the favored people. We are the chosen people. We are the new Israel. And God is favoring us with this incredible empire in which we are doing God's work by converting these uncivilized savages to, you know, the true religion. So Montezinos gets to subvert all of that by using a lot of the elements of those narratives, right? The Americas as the kind of utopia, Americas as a kind of Garden of Eden, the natives as this exotic people whose identity is somewhat unclear, and especially as it relates to Catholics and Portuguese. And Montezinos gets to subvert the self-image of the Spanish and Portuguese as the new Israel. And he gets to do all of that by using their own language against them, as it were, right? Their own narratives against them. So again, there too, it must have felt to him like an incredibly potent mixture rhetorically, you know. And we have to remember, I think, that many people back then, listen, it's still true today, but even more so, many people back then believed in these kinds of things. People thought mythologically. They were not all rationalists. They were not all scientists. And these kinds of narratives, these kinds of stories can have incredible, powerful impact and be incredibly assuaging and comforting, you know.
And that's something that I want to pick up on as well, something you mentioned a little bit before about the Converso, his Converso background and Converso hopes. I mean, where does that fit into this picture?
The Converso hopes? We were, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, we can as Jews imagine, obviously, right? Your identity is stolen from you. You're forced to be a member of another religion that you had no interest in, right? Your whole way of life is now changed. You're now living in incredibly oppressive circumstances where you can't really be yourself. You're not allowed to circulate with your own people. You're not allowed to speak the language that you knew. I mean, not that so many of them spoke Hebrew, but, you know, they might have been praying in Hebrew as Jews before they converted, right? So you're not allowed to pray in your language. You're not allowed to practice your own religion. So the Converso population, it's a whole long topic of conversation. And it's probably true that there were a good percentage of Conversos who were fine being Catholics. You know, they went along with it and maybe they even liked it. It gave them social advantages, economic advantages, you know. There was probably also a large population of the Conversos that was very confused about religion. You know, they practiced some kind of mixture of Christianity and Judaism. There's probably another part of the Converso population that didn't care for religion at all and saw it all as very problematic, especially in this era of, you know, the crazy Inquisition, right? But then you have a part of the Converso population that cares deeply about their background. They know that they're Jewish. They feel Jewish. They are not interested in giving that up. And in fact, in some way, even more so, right? You know, Adarabba, right? The whole Inquisition and the forced conversion made them even prouder to be Jews. It made them care even more about Jewishness. And so Converso hopes were you know, in some sense, almost kind of a more simply a more concentrated form of Jewish hopes. Very, very similar. Yearning for liberation, learning for freedom, learning to be able to be themselves, yearning to be able to live according to their traditions and their ways, which they thought were given by God. So, I mean, they were absolutely similar to what most Jews have yearned for historically, without being forcibly converted. But this added dimension, I think, gave converso hopes and yearnings a particular urgency, a particular poignancy. There was something even more tragic and absurd and surreal about the converso predicament, I think, than the Jewish predicament in general. So, yeah, I think they were very, very prone to messianic beliefs. You know, I've seen, I mean, in Mexico, there was a circle in the 17th century, there was a circle of conversos who believed that one of the children born to one of the women was going to be the Messiah. And that was not so uncommon. This was really lived religion, you know, keeping in mind that conversos did not have access to, most conversos did not have access to the texts of Judaism. They couldn't have read them anyway, but they didn't know from rabbinic Judaism. They cobbled together whatever they could, mostly based on Christian sources, interestingly. So a lot of converso religiosity actually seems very Catholic, which it is in some way.
And I will relate back to my previous series on Shabbos Tzvi, is that this is kind of a precursor here. We're like 16 years before Shabbos Tzvi, and this is a community. Although Rabbi Yaakov Sopcich will live here, and he's the main vocal outspoken critic, or the one standing against Shabbos Tzvi, but Subbatianism really sweeps this community. They all get swept up. Now, what is this? What does the Relacion and Mikveh Israel have and Menashe have to do with Subbatianism? Another question. What is that? What kind of impact does this have on that? But like you're saying, the Messianism plays a big part here in these conversos' background.
A huge part. And Shabbos Tzvi, of course, comes from the converso community in Turkey. And that's not a coincidence, right? He's steeped in Kabbalah. And Kabbalah is often seen as a Mediterranean kind of Sephardic thing, although it was not, of course. And there are certain similarities. Shabtai Tzvi was himself very influenced by, he, Natan of Gaza, and the whole kind of structure of Sabbateanism is influenced very much by Catholic narratives, you know. So, for instance, this whole idea of Yiridah L'Tzorech Aliyah, you know, that Shabbat Tzvi has to go down and descend into the depths of sin in order to redeem himself and everyone else, is really the narrative of Jesus, right? And the Jesus' incarnation. And Montezinos is playing with this too, right? A lot of the converso messianism plays on the converso predicament. In other words, the Messiah, of course, Dafka will come out from this hidden identity, from this hidden location, because that's what the converso represents. The converso was someone who could not be himself or herself, and whose identity and real nature was forced to be suppressed and kind of become subterranean. So it makes a lot of sense that you see among conversos belief in messianic children, right? Very Christ-like. You know, the women were the leaders in converso religiosity. It seems very obvious that a lot of the converso spirituality was actually kind of about or similar to worship. Yeah, I don't want to say worship, but, you know, adulation of the Virgin Mary. So, I mean, it's again, very syncretistic. They didn't know better. They didn't have access to the sources, right? So they did the best they could. So the Shabtai Tzvi episode is very, very much connected with this. Listen, Shabtai Tzvi, that's why he got into trouble with the Sultan, you know. The Sultan said, I don't want you agitating my Jews and getting them all excited and hopeful about messianic possibilities. Montezinos is essentially trying to do the same thing. He's trying to stir up the Jews and tell them, wow, listen, I found the lost 10 tribes. I found at least the tribe of Reuben, and they are powerful, and they are our allies. They're waiting for the signal. Don't lose hope. We're going to come out of this alive and on top. And I want to emphasize that not only will these Reubenites help the Jews escape their being dominated and escape their oppression. But Jews then will be the winners. Jews afterwards, with the lost tribes people, will come out on top. In other words, they will have sovereignty. They will be in control. Very different than Rambam's perception of the Messianic period, for instance. This is a very real political narrative. You know, this is not just we're going to be living in an era where there's no sin and everyone follows God's word and, you know, there's Da'at Elohim, as the prophets say. No, this is also a kind of overturning of the tables, and Jews will now be in control and will dominate. So again, super comforting, super enticing to anyone who feels, wow, we've been stamped on, we've been trod upon, and how horrible that is, you know?
So is that how you mainly view the Relation and its view of the 10 tribes, or again, mainly Reuven here, is that it's a messianic text?
Yes. Yes, it's absolutely. It's a messianic text. It's meant to give comfort and hope to the Jews and or the conversos, to give them strength, right? Chizuk, and to tell them not to despair. Yeah, absolutely. It's also a way of saying, you know, this whole discovery of this new world is not insignificant. It was for a reason. And it will bring us good things, right? Not only is the new world someplace that maybe you could flee to escape the Inquisition, maybe it's not, the Inquisition indeed followed the conversos to the new world in many respects, but not only was the new world a place you could maybe get away from oppression, but it was also a place that was now going to provide the means for the complete overturning of Jewish downtroddenness.
So I want to talk just a little bit more. I mean, there's a lot you go through in your lengthy, again, chapter, essay, whatever. You go through a lot of, you know, in the text, discuss a lot of things that goes on in this short text of Montezino. So we can discuss a little bit about it. I first want to ask you, I've called it the Relation, you said it's a relation. What does that mean, especially as compared to other forms of history or
Right. I'm just using the English term. I mean, relación is fine. That's the Spanish and Portuguese term. Relação is Portuguese, right? Relations, relaciones back then were a genre of report, often reports sent back for official purposes to the monarch or other authorities, but they were also often personal reports, and they were often also very particular reports that had to do with very specific situations, right? And they were usually very short. They were usually not long. They were not chronicles, right? And they were often very partisan, right? So they were written for usually official purposes and to kind of give news or give an update about a specific place or set of circumstances. So in this case, I'm not really sure what to make of that. In other words, is this really an official report? Perhaps because Montezinos gave over the report in public or to private audiences and perhaps private authorities in Amsterdam, it sort of became a relation. But it's clearly also a very personal report also. And there, too, I want to say, going back to what we were just talking about previously, yes, I think this is an eminently political text. It's an eminently messianic text. But I also think there's a wonderfully rich amount of subjectivity there. This is really a kind of personal statement. It's a confused, kind of convoluted, perhaps even slightly insane statement, but it's a statement of his own wrestling with his identity. And that's something that Pirellis goes into a lot in his reading of the text, reading it internally to the text itself and reading it as a psychological, emotional document relating both to Montezinos as a person, but also to Montezinos as a converso. And I think he does a beautiful reading of it. I think it's a great approach to the text. And I'm trying to add to it by looking at the outside context also, what's outside of the text. But I think that's part of what makes this text so believable to many readers. But also it lends the text a kind of multidimensionality, which removes it from the genre of just being a purely kind of messianic, a fevered, you know, messianic speculation. This is also a text with a kind of human depth to it, a human richness. And I think it probably resonated a lot with the readers or the hearers of it, who themselves might have come to a place like Amsterdam as conversos, or they still have family members who are conversos in the Iberian Peninsula or in the Americas. I think this was something that really spoke to them also. You know, this whole episode where he's in the Inquisition jails and he makes this blessing, you know, he's sort of wrestling with his own identity. Who am I? Who are these Native Americans? Are they Jews? They hate the Spaniards. Oh, you know, we hate the Spaniards too. Am I Spanish? Am I an anti-Spaniard because I'm a converso? What? Where am I? Who am I? Very relatable. Really very relatable. This is the converso predicament. And then he comes up with this blessing, fascinating blessing that we could talk about textually, where what the sources are. Thank God that you didn't make me a barbarian, right? An Indian or a Black. Again, absolutely right out of that time and place, where all of these wrestlings with what identity means, what your background means, what your genealogy means, what your race means, who gets to call you what? Do you determine your own identity? Do other people who dominate over you determine your identity, et cetera, et cetera? So I feel like that's important, because if this were just another messianic text, okay, wonderful. It's another messianic text. That's not unimportant, but this becomes something more.
Now, you say this text would resonate with the reader or the listener at the time period. Are there familiarities? Were there other texts like this, whether from conversos or from others of the time period?
Oh, many, many texts. They're circulating all over the place. People loved it. People loved this stuff. you know, you have conversos, you have people who weren't conversos promulgating this stuff. You know, there were Christian versions of it that Jews were probably exposed to. There were Jewish versions of it that they were exposed to. You know, the whole myth of Prester John, the whole myth of this Christian king who lives in the midst of, again, foreign, distant peoples, is taken right out of the mythology of the Lost Ten Tribes. You have this whole Portuguese version, Sebastianismo, based on this the Portuguese king who died in 1581 in a battle in Morocco, and he became a kind of messianic figure for many Portuguese. People ate this stuff up. Ordinary life was difficult, complicated, violent, short. You know, even though we know that the Western Sephardim in places like Amsterdam and London, Curaçao and Suriname were, in the scheme of things, phenomenally wealthy, some of them, the communities were overwhelmingly poor. And, you know, these kinds of narratives gave people a lot of comfort and hope that you know, their own personal lives might not be so good, but collectively, God has not abandoned them. God is still with them, and things will change. So, yeah, they were all over the place. You know, Shlomo Molcho's sermons, you know, Shlomo Molcho, who is the right-hand man, secretary or partner of David Haruveni, a whole other fascinating episode. His sermons were reprinted in Amsterdam. Among the many, many things printed in the 17th century in Amsterdam were a lot of messianic speculation texts, a lot of messianic texts. And, you know, Amsterdam, the Amsterdam community of Sephardim, was one of the places where support for Shabtai Tzvi was incredibly strong. So, yes, it all makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so the text itself, now there's a bunch. You go very in-depth in here, and I did some with Professor Perales, and we're not going to sit here, you know, the whole text. But there is, you know, interesting, you mentioned the blessing. There's the speech of the Reubenites give. There's right, a very, right. He says, come back with the 12 people, right? There's right. An, also the, I think, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it, the Mohanis, the Mohanes, however he pronounces them, right, are the right. Priests or magicians? I don't know which part you want to speak right. about. You can right. talk about any of this. They're all, it's fascinating.
I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating. What I do, Bekitsur, I mean, in sum, what I try to do in my analysis is take the text and not just say it's fantasy and not just say it's bizarre and warped, which it might well be, but try to understand it on its own terms. And therefore, I try to ask a lot of questions about it. Okay, he purports to have been in Nueva Granada. He purports to have circulated with all these Native Americans and to have met these Reubenites. Let's look at the text. Let's look at the details. And does it resonate at all with what we know about Native Americans in the 17th century? There are many, many, many writings from Spaniards about the Native Americans, among other things. So let's compare and contrast and see if that gets us any closer to understanding the text and understanding whether it's coherent, understanding whether it might be factual or whatever. So, right, the whole meeting with the Reubenites is amazing. They have 9 points, almost like 9 commandments that are numbered in the text, and they convey them, this whole kind of again, revelation from these Reubenites and fascinating elements to it, right? The Reubenites don't have interaction with the Native Americans. Only once every 70 months is their connection. They're actually not allowed to really hang out with each other. We also, yes, want you to send us 12 people with beards, 12 men with beards who can write things down. Joseph, you know, lives in the middle of the sea. Who this Joseph is something I ask about, right? And they, you know, insist at the end, don't try to find us. You know, you can't really access us. So it's this revelation that's also quite mystifying, and there's a lot there that's unknown. You know, we're told about the negotiations between where I think Francisco tells Montezinos more, you know, the whole history of how these Reubenites came to the South America. There were all these wars. At first, the Indians were against the Reubenites and tried to fight them, but the Reubenites were so powerful and such good warriors that the Native Americans always lost. And finally, they said, well, let's make an alliance with them. And all the negotiations between the Reubenites and the Native Americans were conducted by a woman. When I look into that, what does that mean? What's going on there? And the advisors, the leaders of the Native Americans, the Mohanes, these right magicians, shamans, chiefs, leaders, warriors, that's a term used by Montezinos. And so again, I try to say, oh well, if he's using all of these, giving us all these descriptions of how the Reubenites dressed, so what can we say about that based on what we know about the state of Native Americana at the time? So let's just talk about a few things, right? It was very common for women to be the negotiators for some of these Native American peoples. So it's very possible that the fact that Montezinos has a woman being the negotiator between the Native Americans and the Reubenites reflects some kind of knowledge on his part, that he knew enough from circulating there personally or from what he read or was told about things there in Nueva Granada and makes use of it, you know. The Mohanes, right, are the shamans, the magicians, the leaders, and we know from a lot of the history of the time and place that the Mohanes were often very, very anti-Spanish. They were the ones who were concerned with keeping the native practices, keeping the native religions. They were often the leaders of the resistance against the Spaniards. So here, too, I find it interesting that the Mohanes, he knows the term, he uses it. He sees them as the wise leaders who tell the Native Americans eventually, we have to stop fighting the Reubenites. It's bad and we're not going to win. And these are actually people who are potentially going to help us. And here, too, you know, there's a sense that he uses the term because it fits into this whole narrative that he's trying to weave together of how the natives side with the Reubenites against the Spaniards. And that is an alliance that is going to come out to all of our benefits at the end of days. So, you know, the Jews and the Native Americans really become like brothers. They become allies. And that's, of course, how the relación ends. Right. The final revelation is where these Reubenites tell the Native Americans tell Montesinos, you know, we're going to emerge at a certain point. You won't exactly recognize us, but we will be allies. We will be your brothers, kind of. And it's an alliance of mutual assistance. And here, too, it's fascinating. I mean, here's this converso using this huge people, much, much larger than the Jews, right? All of these Native American peoples, and using them, projecting onto them a kind of narrative usefulness in Jewish messianic terms, in a Jewish messianic sense. So there, too, he's overturning the Christian narrative and saying, no, the Native Americans are, in fact, going to be part of the messianic story, but they're our allies, actually. They're not going to become part of you. In fact, the opposite, right? So, you know, ultimately, I don't know whether I could not decide that Montesinos really was there. I couldn't decide that he really met all of these Native American peoples. I certainly can't decide that he met members of one of the Lost Ten Tribes. But it does seem that if you read the text carefully, his usage of his knowledge of what we could call local color is enough to convince me that he was there physically, he was there personally, he learned about the context and terrain in the wider sense, he knew about it. I am convinced that he believed that there was veracity and accuracy to all of this. I can't necessarily corroborate that, but I think it's important, you know, to be able to say that. And especially given the Italian version of this letter that I found, of this relación that I found, in which many of the details are the same, I'm convinced that he was there, that he knew enough about the local surroundings to weave together a pretty convincing text, one that was based on a real experience. That doesn't answer the question of whether it's fantasy or not, but I think at the time, the border between fantasy and fact was quite fuzzy. And many, he would certainly not be the only Jew or converso who kind of wanted to be on both sides of that boundary between fact and fantasy.
So, as I said, it's included in, Menashe is the one who kind of includes it, sends it around. He has it in Mikvah Israel, but before that, he sends it to Thomas Thorogood, right, and John Dury, and they have it. Yeah. What kind of is the reception history of Montesinos, and then throughout the centuries of this relación?
I think the reception history of Montesinos, which is not necessarily the reception history of the Mikveh Israel, I think some of the non-Jews who read it were quite taken with it. You know, Montesinos's text, unlike the Mikveh Israel, he's not making a series of arguments, right? It's not an analytical text. It's a narrative. It's a personal kind of fantasy narrative. And you know, it's intriguing. At the same time, obviously, from a Christian perspective, you know, it's completely, what's the word? It's completely, you know, heretical in the sense that it's so obviously giving over a Jewish perspective on it. And I think most of the Christians who read it did not take that well. You know, in other words, they said, oh, this is nonsense. How dare you? No. This is not the way it's going to work out when the Messiah comes. And I think most Jewish readers, I think many of the, as is so often the case, you know, there's a split between the elite intellectuals and the masses of the people. And I think a lot of Jews took this text to be very comforting and very convincing. And then a lot of the intellectuals minimized it and said, yeah, yeah, well, whatever, you know, nice try. So I think the reception history of it is on the whole negative. I think most people dismissed it. But, you know, the way I read Mikveh Yisrael and Menashe's writing in Mikveh Yisrael, I think Menashe himself was very convinced of the text's accuracy. He was convinced that Montezinos was a credible witness. At least that's what he writes. You know, he says that a few times in a few different ways. We have no reason to doubt him. He comes from a good family. He's credible as a witness. So I think Menashe, who himself we know had messianic leanings, I think he really found this text very, very convenient and useful.
Okay, and like you said, it really is a fantastical narrative, you know, well worth reading. Which again, so there's the, I think there's the Hebrew edition of Mikveh Yisrael, which is in, there's the English edition, which is the 1652 translation. Is there really a newer edition, translation of Lacion? It's really kind of those older editions, translations.
Of Montezinos' text?
Yeah, Montezinos.
No. What I will do now is I'm working on an essay about a different episode of Sephardic colonization. In 1658, there's a journey of a few ships that are bringing Sephardic settlers to a new Dutch colony in what's called the Cayenne, the Dutch Essequibo, the Dutch Wild Coast, as it's called, and near Suriname. And so when I finish that essay, what I am hoping to do is put out a new edition with the Montezinos essay, this essay about the 1658 Essequibo journey, which also has a text to it. And then I have another essay about another 17th century Sephardic traveler from Amsterdam, Moshe Pereira de Paiva, who goes to India, to Cochin, and writes a very interesting little text about the Jews of Cochin. So I would like to publish those three essays, and I want to put new translations of each of the original texts with each of the essays. So I'm hoping to, you know, I don't know, next year, hopefully, God willing. But yeah, I think these texts are important to read. It's easy to dismiss them as sort of lunacy and fantasy, but I think they're very reflective of a very real strand of Jewish thinking and Jewish life and experience of the time.
Yeah, absolutely. They're really interesting. So, okay. So now let me just ask you in closing here, reading on Montezinos, there's, you know, Professor Perelis, we mentioned the previous episode. There's some of your books were brilliant, they were expensive, but some of the books you've now redone and kind of they're pretty affordable. I can link to those, but this is not available. Is this on Montezinos? Is this available anywhere? Your academia page maybe? Where can anyone get this, or they can't?
I think the PDF is available online. You know, academia.edu is the source that, you know, one is not supposed to mention that has a lot of material. But yes, the Brill volume was actually put in, it was my Brill book that this essay appears in was actually made into two volumes, which a decision I was not happy with. And it's very expensive, as you say. This essay does not appear in the reprints of you know, the secret societies or underground societies is one title, both put out by Marcus Wiener in out of New Jersey and Princeton. But that has all the materials on blacks and Africans who are enslaved and none of the Native American stuff. So for now, yeah, it's you people have to look online or take the book out of the library or encourage your library to order the book, Swimming in the Christian Atlantic, which I think has some fascinating material. I mean, I find this material just rich and compelling. There's two chapters of that book, the original Swimming in the Christian Atlantic book, one of which deals with a converso in Cartagena de las Indias who's denounced by a slave and very colorful and crazy episode. And then another chapter about a conversa woman who herself is of half African descent in Mexico City. And I would love to at some point turn each of those chapters into a mini series. I feel like they would make a great, you know, TV treatment kind of thing, because there's just so much interpersonal, so much human conflict and politics. There's magic, there's sex, there's race, religion. I find it very resonant. I mean, it's tragic stuff. It's sometimes hard to read, but it's really very real, I find. So anyway, yeah, I hope that's helpful for your readers, your listeners. Yeah.
Yes, I'll link those in the show's notes as well, even though they're not specifically about this. And if I find, like I said, this on academia, I will link this as well. So thank you, Professor Schwartz, for joining me.
What a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. A pleasure to talk with you about all of this. Thank you again.